Council Committee on Trade, Economic Development, Small Business Development, Tourism, Employment and Labour. And also, good morning to the honourable members of the provincial legislators. Also, good morning to our panelists, Professor Owen Dean, and our panelists from the CIPC. Also, good morning to the staff of Parliament, the committee, the advocate Fanameve from the legal unit, staff from the communication unit of Parliament, PMG, stakeholders and observers on this process of lawmaking. Good morning to everyone. So the PL from our provinces. Good morning. This morning we continuing with a workshop. Last week our focus was on the copyright law. This morning we will be dealing then with the performance protection. And then in the afternoon we will then get the briefing on both the copyright as well as the performance protection. The department led by the deputy minister will be here in the afternoon. I see some members of officials from the department are here. Sine Saroch is also here from the department. But in the afternoon, we'll be joined by Deputy Minister Majola, who will be making opening remarks on the two bills and then hand over to the DDG responsible for the program that deals with the legislation in the department. As I indicated, then after that, the members will then be allowed to ask questions for clarities, both the members from the National Council of Provinces as well as the provincial legislatures members. Then after that, then Advocate Fanameva will just give us an overview of the Constitutional Court outcome on the Principal Act on copyright. But the further details and analysis will further be communicated in other meetings of the committee when we deal with the DTIC. There's still a number of meetings that we'll be having with the DTIC other than just the legislation, but other briefings. So we'll deal with the full analysis when we have one of the meetings. Let me then hand over to advocate, or first let me hand over to Ms. Madie to indicate members who are present and also the provinces that are present, and also if there are any apologies. Over to you, Ms. Madie.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. In terms of the members of our committee of present, we have yourself, Honourable Moiman, Honourable Boshoff, Honourable Lon, Honourable Blasi. I know that Honourable Matabula was trying to get in, and we've got one apology from Honourable Mushodi. In terms of provinces, I have had confirmations from the Western Cape Provincial Legislature, the Mpumalanga Provincial Legislature. I can't really speak to the other confirmations that I haven't received yet.
Okay, no, thank you so much. Thank you very much. As I indicated, I have said the one point that I left out is that also in the program, they will deal with the process that we will be taking after having received then the briefing. And also members have engaged with the briefings, and then we outline the process that will be taking both in the committee as well as in the provincial legislatures. Yeah, so that's one of the items that we'll be dealing with. At this stage, let me welcome Advocate Fanameve and request her to facilitate the next process. Over to you, Advocate.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to you and good morning to all the members. Chair, the first presenter in our panel this morning is not a stranger to the members. He also assisted members last week on the copyright. So it is Dr. Owen Dean, and maybe just to remind members who this is that will be talking to you. He's done his BA LLB at Stellenbosch, and then also he's got a doctorate in copyright from Stellenbosch. He practiced as a specialist copyright attorney with an emphasis on litigation with Spoor and Fisher, which is a leading intellectual property law firm. He practiced with them for 48 years, and he conducted in excess of 50 high court copyright cases during that time. He also set up and operated the chair of intellectual property law at the Stellenbosch University as a professor. And he is also the author of a handbook for South African copyright law, which is a standard textbook on the subject and an authority that is frequently quoted by courts. He's also the principal editor of Introduction to Intellectual Property Law, which is used as a textbook in South African universities. Dr. Dean has published in excess of 100 articles in South African and international legal journals, and he served for 20 years on the Minister's Statutory Intellectual Property Advisory Committee, as well as chairman of the Copyright Subcommittee. He was also a principal draftsman of 8th of Copyright Amendment Act and speaker on copyright at numerous domestic and local seminars, including on behalf of WIPO. He's also a member of the WIPO panel of arbitrators. So if I can welcome Dr. Dean and to assist the members on performance protection. Dr. Dean, you have, I see from the agenda, 50 minutes. So as we did last week, at about 40 minutes, I will switch my camera on, which will give you an indication that you have 10 minutes left. Thank you very much. If we could just have Dr. Dean's slides shared for him, please.
Good. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Mr. Chairman of the meeting. Once again, I'm grateful for the opportunity to present at this committee meeting, and I hope I can be of some assistance to the members of the committee. So my task now is to talk about the Performance Protection Act as it currently exists. Can I have the next slide, please? Now, when you give consideration to the Performance Protection Act, it's important to distinguish between performance protection and copyright. There is some affinity between the two. One can almost regard performance protection as a cousin of copyright, but there are also very significant differences between the two bodies of law. I must say there are certain conventions which have been passed in recent years relating to performance protection, which are conventions which no doubt we will aspire to join. We are not currently members of them. And they have the effect of bringing performance protection a little closer to copyright than it is at the moment. Now, copyright protects works. We heard last week what works they are. I won't enumerate them all, but the most important ones are literary, music, artistic works, cinematograph films, etc. So the subject of the protection is the material expression of the author's intellectual output. It's a material object that is being protected. When you come to a performance, it is the delivery or the rendition of a work that one is protecting. To give you an example, what I'm busy doing now is I am actually presenting a work to you. The slides, which are before you, and the written text, which I've also supplied and which I think has probably been distributed to you, is the work which I am performing. So these slides are protected by copyright, and my delivering these the content of these slides to you this morning is my performance. The two are quite closely connected, but there is a distinction. The subject matter of the copyright is a material object, and the subject matter of the performance protection is my sitting here and delivering the content of the slides to you. Can we have the next slide, please? Now, the Performance Protection Act relates to the performance of works. And I'll just read to you what the Act actually says in this connection. It says, the performances protected by the Act are those of actors, singers, musicians, dancers, and other persons who act, sing, deliver, declaim, play, or otherwise perform literary music, dramatic and dramatico-musical and artistic works and expressions of folklore. So what is being performed is a work. Now, the Performance Protection Act doesn't actually define what it means by a work, but since we're dealing with intellectual property, and as I mentioned, performance protection is really the cousin of copyright, it is necessary to give the term work the same interpretation as it has in the Copyright Act. So this means that a performance of something which isn't scripted, which is an impromptu performance. Imagine a juggler stands up on a stage and he starts juggling a whole bunch of balls. He's not delivering a work, so his performance would not be protected by the Performance Protection Act. Now, as with copyright, there is a treaty involved in providing the law in this area, and that is firstly the Rome Convention, which protects performers, and also the TRIPS Agreement. Now, we heard about the TRIPS Agreement last week, and the TRIPS Agreement is an agreement of the World Trade Organization, and it provides that members of that agreement, of which we are one, must apply the provisions of the Rome Convention. So we actually never ever joined the Rome Convention, but by virtue of the fact that we are a member of TRIPS and TRIPS obliges us to adopt it, we are indirectly a member of the Rome Convention. And our Performance Protection Act is really designed to give effect to the provisions of the Rome Convention. The common law protects what is known as personality rights. That is the right to your reputation and the right to your personal confidentiality and so forth. And performance protection rights are a little akin to personality rights. They really attach to the person of the person giving the performance. So there is this somewhat strange relationship between copyright and performance protection. Now, our Performance Protection Act dates from 1967, and it has retrospective effect, which means that even though it only came into operation in 1967, it actually ex post facto gives protection to performances that were made prior to 1967. Now, when you talk of a performance that is being protected, it is each and every performance which a performer does. So, for instance, what I'm now doing as we sit here, or as we are presently engaged with, I am delivering a performance. That performance is protected. If tomorrow I go and deliver this same presentation to a group of students, for instance, that is another performance, and it is separately protected from the one that I'm giving today. So each and every time I deliver this presentation, I am making a new performance, and each of those performances has its own protection as a separate entity. That's important to remember, because think, for instance, of a pop singer who's doing a tour of South Africa. He might appear in 10 different cities, and he might give 3 performances in a day, and each performance in that day is a separate performance and enjoys its own protection. That's unlike copyright, where you have an original work, and that's the work which is protected forever hereafter. There's only one work, and the copyright attaches to it. As I say, and I want to emphasize that with the performance, each and every performance is a separate, call it work, it's perhaps the wrong term, but a separate item which enjoys protection. Can we have the next slide, please? Now, as with copyright, there are certain conditions that must be met for a performance to enjoy protection. Like copyright, it is not registered, and the protection exists automatically. One needs takes no steps at all to obtain protection. And the law giving protection to this performance actually creates an item of property. It's an intangible item of property, because you can't touch it, and it exists in theory more than as a practical reality. And as I've said before, each and every performance is a separate property item. So if I do this presentation tomorrow, I'm creating another additional property item. And it is effectively scripted works, as I said. A juggler, for instance, who's not working according to a script, he's just doing something impromptu, his protection wouldn't be protected, his performance. One of the items which is specifically enumerated as being a work, the performance of which can be protected, is folklore or traditional work. That is a little bit it's an unusual form of presentation, because sometimes folklore and traditional works may not exist in a material form. They've been done over generations and centuries, and they have a fixed content, but they're not actually, or may not actually be reduced into some material form, such as writing or a video or a movie or whatever. But the copyright, I mean, the Performance Protection Act actually specifically says that performances of folklore and traditional works are also entitled to protection. Next slide, please. So what are the conditions which must be met for protection to subsist in a performance? They firstly deal with the place of performance. And that means that a performance which takes place in South Africa or in a country which is a member of the TRIPS agreement, which is virtually the whole world, in principle, is entitled to protection in South Africa. So that's the first condition which can give you performance protection. The second is if it's broadcasted live in South Africa or a TRIPS country. And the third possibility is that if it is first recorded in South Africa or a TRIPS country. The basis of international protection in general in intellectual property is reciprocity. You find this is provided for in the Berne Convention with regard to copyright. And what that means is that each member country must grant to foreign works from other member countries the same protection as it gives to its own works. That's in copyright. And that principle is known as national treatment. And the outcome of that is that copyright, if a work is made in South Africa, it is automatically protected throughout the world in terms of that reciprocal arrangement. Now, our Performance Protection Act specifically says that foreign performances are only protected in South Africa to the same extent and in the same way as our performances would be protected in those other countries. That's a different proposition to the national treatment, which I described. National treatment says you must protect foreign works in the same way as you protect your own works. What our Performance Protection Act says, we will only protect foreign works in the same way as those countries, or the countries from which those performances emanate, protect South African performances. So there's not the same degree of reciprocity in performance protection law as there is in copyright. Next slide, please. So sorry, before we move on, can I just go back to that slide? So provided one of these conditions are met, the place of the performance or the place of the broadcast or the first recording of the broadcast is met, South Africa or one of the other member countries, the performance protection right exists automatically. Okay, next slide. As in copyright, there is a limited term of protection. Once again, the magic figure is 50 years. For performance protection, it is the protection lasts for 50 years after the performance took place, or if it is the performance was recorded in some form of device, CD or whatever, 50 years from the time the recording was made. So, as I said, the magic figure is 50 years. So, coming back to my point about each performance being a separate item of property, my performance that I'm giving you now will be protected for 50 years until the 50 years after the 24th of October 2022. If I give a similar performance to students tomorrow, that performance will be protected until the 25th of October, 50 years hence. So this once again re-emphasizes the fact that each individual performance is a separate item of property. Next slide, please. So now, what in practice does the Performance Protection Act give to performers by way of protection? The first point is that the rights which vest in the performance belong to the performer. As in the case of copyright, where the author is in general the first owner of the copyright, in the case of performance protection, the performer is the owner of the item of property which comes into being by virtue of the performance. Now that item of property gives a monopoly to the performer in respect of certain acts known as restricted acts. Here again there's a close parallel with the Copyright Act, because the Copyright Act also gives authors protection in respect of a whole bundle of restricted acts. The restricted acts in the case of performance are somewhat more limited than in the case of, for instance, a musical work under the Copyright Act. And the restricted acts are set out in this slide and in the next one. And they are broadcasting or communicating an unfixed performance. In other words, that's a live performance. So when I give a live performance, I'm entitled to control the broadcasting or the communicating of my live performance. Once it's been recorded, then it's no longer an unfixed performance. But while it's an unfixed performance, I can control broadcasting and communicating. Secondly, I can control making a recording of a live performance. I'm sure most of you will have been to stage productions or plays or performances of one form or another on a stage, where it is often said that it is prohibited to make videos or take photographs of the performance. That is a commonplace warning which is given at these sort of events. And that is giving effect to this right on the part of the performer that he can control the making of the recording of his live performance. And then the next restricted act is making reproductions of a recording of a performance. So I can authorize a record company to record my performance, but the record company requires a further permission to reproduce that initial recording. Next slide, please. This restricted act setting out here is one which is very topical and very controversial. It's quite a new addition to our Performance Protection Act. It's known as needle time. And that means by means of a commercial record, in other words, the record made by a record company, without paying the performer a royalty, broadcasting the performance using the record, transmitting the performance in the diffusion service using the record, and communicating the performance to the public using the record. So what we're dealing with here is no longer a live performance. A recording has been made of that performance, and I, as a performer, can control the broadcasting, transmission, and communication of that record. And that enables me, at the end of the day, to impose payment of a royalty on the record company, or not on the record company, a royalty on the person who wants to use the record for performing my or giving the rendition of my performance. This leads us into quite a complicated area because the sound recording itself, in other words, the product of the record company, also has similar rights to these. So when the SABC uses a record to broadcast my performance, the SABC requires a license from me as the performer to use the record to show my performance, but it also needs a license from the record company to make a public performance of the record. There's very fine distinctions in intellectual property law, and it's actually important to analyze situations very carefully to see what rights are involved and who isn't able to claim payment of royalties or prohibit the use of the works. It can, of course, get even more complicated because supposing I'm a singer and I have singing a song on as part of my performance, more works come into play because the song is a musical work, and the melody of the song is a musical work, and the lyrics of the song are a literary work. So a whole bundle of rights owners can get into the act here and require payment of royalties and or exercise control over the record being used to give a public performance, and how all of those rights hang together and can be properly administrated is one of the most difficult and in South Africa controversial aspects of this area of the law. Can we have the next slide, please? So, the performer has a right of property in his performance. He can authorize or not authorize the restricted acts which fall within the scope of his rights of property. These are the restricted acts. If a restricted act, any one of the restricted acts, is performed without the permission of the performer, then we have infringement. And that's the same with copyright. In copyright, you have restricted acts for a literary work, reproduction, making adaptations, and so forth. And if those acts are performed without the copyright owner's permission, you have civil copyright infringement. So in this respect, performance protection is more or less on all fours with copyright and the way copyright protects works. So the consent of the performer is the material issue here. And what can often arise in practice is a determination of whether in any given situation consent has been given. And it's very important to be able to decide that issue, because it's the difference between valid or legitimate use of a performance and infringing use of a performance. Now, the Act, the Performance Protection Act, has provisions which deal with this issue of consent and can mitigate the requirement that the individual performer must give the consent. So there are situations where other persons or circumstances can give rise to a consent. And the first of those is the collective consent by a manager of a group. Now you can imagine a group like Ladysmith Back Mabatha, where you have maybe 30, or I don't know how many people there are in the choir, but each of them is a performer, and each of them has a right in respect of his or her personal performance. So anybody who wants to make a record of a performance by Ladysmith Black Mabatha or broadcast it or perform any of the restricted acts needs to get the consent of each and every one of those performers. Now that can be quite a cumbersome and complicated process. And so the Act says that in this situation, although the manager of the group actually holds no rights in his own capacity, he can give consent on behalf of the entire group. That's a practical measure which makes the whole process somewhat more workable. Then there are instances where the Act deems that consent has been given. And the first of those is when a broadcast has been authorized and the broadcaster at a later stage subsequently rebroadcasts the performance. In that case, the rebroadcast is deemed to have been authorized by the performer. And then the second item under number two on the slide deals with a situation where somebody who says, I'm the manager of this group, and I give you consent to use the performances of all of the members of the group, and so you can go ahead. And it then turns out that that person, in fact, is not the manager, and he doesn't have authority to consent on behalf of all the performers. And here what the Act says, it says is that the person who uses the performance, believing that he has consent, can be deemed to have consent if it was reasonable that he could assume that he had consent. In other words, it's very difficult for a show producer or broadcaster to really know whether someone who says he's the manager actually is the manager. And so the law is not going to penalize the person who acts in good faith in that situation. Next slide, please. Of course, as in copyright law, when you're talking about infringement, whether it's civil or criminal, the act is an infringing act, doing the restricted act without consent, if it's done in respect of a substantial part of the item of property. So you don't have to, you can infringe the performer's right in a performance even if you do just an excerpt from it, as long as it is a substantial part. Now, the point is that, as in copyright, the law makes or gives rise or makes provision for civil law infringement as well as criminal law infringement. So in certain circumstances, infringing the performer's right can be a criminal offense, as can be the case with copyright. So when is it a criminal offense? Performing a restricted act in relation to a substantial part, distributing an infringing copy, that is a copy which was made without authority. As it were, it was conceived in sin because the person making the copy was not entitled to make it. And the person who distributes that infringing copy can also infringe copyright in a criminal context. And the third form of criminal offense is possessing a master of the infringing copy. And by what is meant by that is that when a performance is recorded, the initial recording is known in practice as the master copy, because that is the version of the recorded performance which is going to be used as the basis for multiplication. When records are issued, those records are made by reproducing that master. So the master is like a mold almost for producing infringing copies. So you can commit a criminal offense by possessing or making the master of an infringing copy. But in the case of all of these infringing activities, the accused must be shown to have so-called guilty knowledge. That means that the state must be able to show that the person knew when he committed the act, distributed the infringing copy, for instance, he knew that what he was working with was an infringing copy. So there is will be an onus on the state to prove that the person in the dock, the accused, actually knew that the copies that he was distributing were infringing copies. Next slide, please. Now, in the case of civil law infringement, the remedies that are available to the performer are firstly an interdict, in other words, an order by the court which says that you are prohibited from continuing to perform the infringing act, distributing unlawful copies of the performance, for instance. Secondly, you can claim what is known as patrimonial damages. That means your actual losses, the extent to which you're out of pocket as a result of the offense being committed. When you claim damages of that sort, there is an onus on the rights owner to actually demonstrate to the court that he has actually suffered monetary damages, and he also has to quantify the amount of the damages. In other words, he has to come to court and say to the court, I've suffered 10,000 rands worth of loss, and the way I've computed my 10,000 rand is the following. And if the court agrees with all of that, then it will make a damages award. Now, that actually can be quite difficult in practice to put together that sort of evidence and that sort of information. And so the law looks for simpler alternatives to providing a means for the rights owner to get proper compensation for the infringement. And in this instance, the Performance Protection Act entitles the Minister of Trade and Industry to specify penalties in an amount which he determines, which can be a substitute for having to prove the actual damages. There's a similar provision to this in American copyright law, and the way the American law refers to this situation is they call it statutory damages. So this is virtually statutory damages, which leads me to the next point. There's not really much difference between the penal damages and the statutory damages, which the minister is able to specify. And then also the rights owner can obtain an order from the court providing for the destruction of the master copies. Obviously, if you destroy the master copies, then it becomes impossible for the infringer to carry on with his infringement in any event. I mean, the first remedy, the interdict, puts a prohibition on his carrying on the unlawful act, but by destroying the masters, you have a sort of a belt and braces approach, because you take away from him the wherewithal to make the infringing copies anyway. And then finally, the court can award costs to the performer if he is successful in his case. So that's what lies in store for you as a performer if you decide to sue somebody for infringing your performance right. Next slide, please. We now look at the criminal sanctions for infringement. So these are the penalties that the criminal court can impose on an infringer when he has infringed the performer's protection right. The first is a fine and or imprisonment. The second is a little bit akin to the penalty damages under the civil proceedings. The court can, in addition to providing a normal fine, it can provide a second fine, which the infringer must pay to the performer. Normally, when a criminal court imposes a fine, the money actually goes to the state. It doesn't go to the victim or the aggrieved person. But in the case of performance protection, there's this unusual provision that the court can impose a normal fine, which goes to the state, and then it can impose a second fine, which is a lump sum which the infringer, the accused person, has to pay to the performer himself. And then finally, in the criminal case, the court can also order the destruction of the master copies used for making the infringing copies. Next slide, please. Now, as in the case of copyright, there are situations in which public policy, the weighing up of the interests of the public at large against the interests of the rights owner, and exceptions to the restricted acts or the infringement can be provided for. Now that happens in copyright law, and it also happens in the performance protection environment. There are these exceptions or exemptions. The terms exception and exemption are almost synonymous, but the exemption underlines a very important point, and that is that an exception only comes into play when infringement has taken place. If there has been no infringement, for instance, a less than a substantial part of a performance has been used, that's perfectly legitimate, and so no exception is necessary. So you only talk of an exception or an exemption when there has been use of at least a substantial part of the performance. So the specific items that are identified in the Act as being attracting exceptions are private study and personal use. That is very similar to the Copyright Act. Criticism or review, there's an equivalent to that in the Copyright Act. Use for teaching, scientific purposes, legal proceedings, demonstrating equipment, recording equipment, and so forth. That's also has equivalence in the Copyright Act. And then finally, what is known as ephemeral recordings by a broadcaster. And what that means is that, and this also applies in copyright, if the rights owner gives, say, the SABC a license to broadcast his performance in this case, it may not suit the broadcaster to do an actual live broadcast. He might want to postpone it until the next day, postpone the broadcast until the next day. And in order to do that, he has to make a recording because it's not the live performance. And that recording made for temporary purposes to enable a broadcast to take place at a later stage is referred to as an ephemeral recording or an ephemeral copy. And what the law, both Copyright Act and the Performance Protection Act say is that the broadcaster can make these ephemeral recordings subject to the condition that they are destroyed after the broadcast has taken place or within a certain period. So it's a temporary recording. It's not a recording that can be kept for indefinitely. Next slide, please. Right, now how does the performer in fact generate income for his performance? The most common way is to grant a license. In other words, if the SABC wants to broadcast the performance of Ladysmith Black and Bartha, they go to the manager and he says, fine, you can make a broadcast of our performance, but you're going to have to pay us 10,000 Rand. That is a royalty, which is payable in terms of the license, which is the permission to actually broadcast the performance. And that's really similar to copyright, exactly the same situation or provisions apply. Copyright can be assigned as well as licensed. You may recall that when I spoke last week, I drew a distinction between an assignment and a license. I said that an assignment of copyright is like selling your house. You divest yourself completely of the ownership of the property. You kiss it goodbye, and thereafter the person who acquires the right from you, the assignee, can do with it what he wants. He's the boss, and you're out of the picture. That's an assignment. A license, on the other hand, is a permission to do something which is comparable to the lease of a property. When I rent a property, my own property, I'm putting a tenant into my property, I remain owner of the house. I mean, the fact that I'm allowing the tenant to occupy the house says nothing about my ownership of the right of the property. What is in fact happening is that as the owner, I have the right to occupy the house, and I am making that right available to my tenant. It's one of the rights which flow from owning a property, and as the normal situation, I would charge a monthly rental for my property. That's like a license of a performance right or of copyright subject to royalty. Now, there is no provision in the Performance Act, Performance Protection Act, for the performer's right to be licensed. And that then means that the performer actually cannot sell off his right or his property. I mentioned earlier that there is some degree of similarity between performer's rights and personality rights, like the right to your reputation. In the same way as you can't sell the right to your reputation that attaches to you personally, so in terms of the Performance Protection Act, you cannot divest yourself of your performance right. It attaches to you as a person. I find this quite surprising, quite honestly, because performers' rights are intellectual property rights, and in the case of every other form of intellectual property, trademarks, copyright, patents, designs, the ownership of the property can be assigned or transferred. So why this is the position in the Performance Protection Act is not clear to me, other than that it is something which is very personal to the performer. Next slide, please. That really brings me to the end of what I have to say about the Performance Protection Act. It's actually, in some ways, quite a strange piece of legislation because it's been on the statute book now for about the best part of 50 years, and I'm only aware of one case ever coming to the court in terms of the Performance Protection Act. So either the law is not understood, or it's perhaps not even known to a vast proportion of performers, or otherwise performers really don't see their way clear to trying to enforce these rights, which I find surprising because the rights have value and they can be of benefit to performers. But be it as it may, it is a very underutilized form of protection. And perhaps in future, when the Act is amended, performers will feel more inclined to exercise their rights. Well, thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dean. Then, members, if I can introduce our next panelist, there will be an opportunity for discussion and questions after the next panelist has presented. Our next panelist is Mr. Kadi Peche. He's a senior manager in copyright at the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission, CIPC, as you might know it. He has 18 years' experience in the intellectual property field.
Recording in progress.
Sorry. And he represented the CIPC in the Copyright Review Commission, which was established by the Minister of Trade and Industry in 2010. He remains part of the South African delegation at the WIPO SCCR, and he is currently part of the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition team on these bills. He holds both a BProc and an LLB degree. I'm aware that he has done a lot of training on these subject matters, and I'm sure he will bring a little bit of a practical perspective as well, coming from the department that is implementing these acts. Thank you. If I can hand over to you, Kadi, and then I'm not sure if it was arranged for you to share or for us to share your presentation. We do have it. If we can perhaps share it for him, please. Thank you. Oh, just to say, Cardi, I know that you've got 30 minutes. So at 20 minutes, I'll switch my camera on so that you know that there's 10 minutes left. Thank you. Gadi, are you ready? I can see that you are on the platform, but I'm not hearing anything. You are unmuted, so you should be able to speak. Oh, I see that he had a problem in respect of connection. Gadi, are you here now? Apologies, members. It seems that we just have a bit of a problem. Cardi, if you have a problem with your microphone, can you maybe just type a message for us so that we can just see what the problem is, and then we can perhaps deal with that. Okay, so it seems that Cardi is having some problems in respect of his microphone. Marge, I now I'll have to ask you guys to assist in respect of the technology challenge.
Yeah, Africa Trend America, I would actually recommend that he log in and log out again. Beyond that, I think maybe just try removing his headphones if he's using, maybe the microphone and the headphones are not working. And then just using his device to speak from which to speak from. I would recommend that. So if you can maybe just try logging out and then logging in again. Okay, it's logged out. I'm just waiting for him to log back in. He hasn't tried to log back in yet. And because from the metro, we seem to have lost him. He hasn't come back in yet.
Okay. I'm going to try and see if we can get hold of him in another way, Maria. Oops, put myself on mute and talking. I apologize to members. I see he's now just back in the waiting room. Hopefully we will be able to hear him now. Gadi, can you are muted at the moment. Can you unmute yourself and then we can just test if we can hear you? Yes, you're unmuted. Please speak now. We are still not able to hear you. Are you using earphones? Perhaps you can remove your earphones. We are still not able to hear you.
Advocate Fanda Medeva, I can ask IT to assist you. I don't know how they're going to assist him, though, because, I mean, ultimately it's all going to come down to his device, which they will obviously not have any control over. Chi, maybe we'll be guided by you, Chairperson. Maybe we can move on to, can I use a phone? Yes, I mean, obviously, I see there's a message from Hadi saying, can I use a phone? Yes, he's able to use a phone. The most important thing that we need to do is we need to be able to hear him. So if he can maybe log in with his phone, we can try that.
Maybe we can engage with the Professor Dean, the presentation in the meantime, while he's still sorting himself out. I don't know if that will assist.
Thank you, Chair. Let me maybe hand it back to you for questions on the current presentation. I agree with you. It will help because we now need to quickly sort out some technology. And once we've sorted that out, not to waste time, I think maybe if I can hand to you for some discussion. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Honorable members, we've just received the MBD presentation. From Professor Dean. It's time now for members to engage with the presentation. If there are any questions of clarity, you are free to do so. I will see if the hands. Maybe Madea can also help me with if there are any hands.
I don't see any hands, Chairperson. Oh, I see Honorable Mema.
Oh, okay. You can go ahead, Honorable Mema.
Thank you, Chair. Let me have a welcome in the presentation from Professor Dean. There's an aspect that Professor Dean raised at the end of his this presentation that there has been an absence of litigation on the implementation of this act, despite the fact that it has been operation for the last 6 years. I think that's what the professor indicated, and he alluded to the fact that probably could be the maybe probably level of awareness in terms of the importance of this legislation. What I want to find out from the professor just in terms of the implementation of this act, or just an observation, given the fact that I believe the rationale behind this bill is to close a particular lacuna that that has been identified with regard to particularly the those that are on the receiving end, the vulnerable musician and performers. Just in terms of his assessment, is there any observation that he could put forward in terms of the difficulties with regard to the gap in the performance rights, particularly a lack of protection of the intellectual property rights of the performers, particularly those from the historically disadvantaged groups. I think there would definitely have been key players, whether you call them color records or other records that might be dominant in the field of performance. Whether is there any observation that you could narrate that will make us much more keen in terms of, I mean, understanding the rationale behind this bill being sent back to Parliament? Are there any contentious issues in relation to what is happening nationally or internationally that could have led to this bill being sent back? And if there is such an observation or a sense in terms of the referral, could the referral be as a result of a strong lobbying by strong interest groups as opposed to the vulnerable groups in relation to the industry? Yes, thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Before the professor responds, I want to check if CIPC, because it is indicating that yes, connected is in this one. I would suggest that we hear from him first and ask the professor to note your question. But also, Honorable Mimang, we had advised the panelists not to comment on the merits and demerits of the two bills. They should just focus on the law, not the amendments of the bills. So perhaps he can just respond on the why there has only been one case. Perhaps if I may add, what is the role of the collecting management organization, collective society? Isn't it there as to whether there are any infringements? Let's first check if the CIPC is ready to make the presentation. I see there's some feedback. Maybe it's from their side. Over to you, CIPC.
Thank you very much. I apologize.
Switch one of the devices. It seems like you have two devices that are open, so you must switch one so that there is no feedback. Switch off one. Yes.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good morning, Chairperson and honorable members of the Select Committee. Advocate Van der Merwe, thank you very much for the nice introduction. Let me also acknowledge the presence of my principals from the DTIC under the leadership of Dr. Evelyn Masoja, who are also present on the platform. Again, we are honored to present here as CIPC in this important workshop that is aimed at assisting the Select Committee members to deliberate on the two bills that are before them. Chair and honorable members, let me just mention at the outset that duplications and repetitions from my presentation and the presentation from Dr. Dean are inevitable as we all prepared our presentation from the same legislation, being the Performance Protection Act. But I'm of the view that the two prepared presentations can coexist and still be useful to the honorable members in terms of assisting them to understand these rights that belong to the performers. So in my presentation, I will not pronounce or deal with the Performance Protection Bill at all, but I will deal with the Performance Protection Act in its current form. So, Chairperson, if for whatever reason I happen to enter into the Performance Protection Bill, please pardon me, it will be unintentional. The idea is not to go there. So, having observed all protocol, Chair. Let me go straight to my presentation, which I guess can be screened. Thanks. So yeah, we can just go into the next slide. Chair, in this slide, I've just selected the topics which I think are relevant for me to engage honorable members on the Performance Protection Act. So because I don't have much time, let me not go to them individually in this slide. I will deal with them when I get to their slides. So we can go to another slide. So, Chairperson, let me just, because I'm using a phone, I'm trying to, seems as if I lost some slides. I got them. So let me just mention that South African Copyright Act, it's a primary legislation in the copyright system, and it is our national law, and it has been enacted in compliance with the Berne Convention, which I always call it the mother of all the conventions in the copyright field. So we can safely say our Copyright Act is compliant with the Berne Convention, and South Africa is a signatory to Berne. So being a signatory to Berne, we are able to get the benefits that Berne Convention members do have for their nationals. Now, workshop has already taken place on a copyright, but it suffices here just to mention that Copyright Act, it is that national law that lists all the categories of works that enjoy copyright, and it also lists the requirements that should be met to attain copyright protection for such works. So in comparison to Performance Protection Act, I've always viewed Performance Protection Act as a secondary legislation. It is still our national law, but I have always thought and regarded it as a secondary legislation, because even the rights that it grants are related rights, are neighboring rights. It remains our national law, and it is in compliance with WIPO Rome Convention, which was enacted or concluded in 1961. And we can safely say, to a certain extent, our Performance Protection Act complies with WIPO Phonograms and Performance Treaty, which was concluded in 1996. I'm saying so because in 2002, when we introduced collective management of rights in sound recording, Section 5, Subsection 1 of the Performance Protection Act was amended so that it can accommodate performers in this collective management of rights in sound recording. Currently, CIPC is the regulator in this collective management of rights in sound recording. So our act was amended so that the performers become the beneficiaries of the collective management rights in sound recording as well. Now, just to be specific, Performance Protection Act is a piece of legislation that is aimed at performers. It recognizes their performance and it grants them the rights over those performances. in the same manner as Copyright Act will give rise to creators of copyright works, such as books, films, etc. So Performance Protection Act specifically grants the performers for their performances. Let me also mention that performances are a product of creativity in the same manner as copyright works are a product of creativity. But we see performance being a display of talent when a singer is singing, when an actor is acting or casting his or her role in a film. So performance is more of displaying that talent. That is why when film producers, when they have a script before them, they will always search for a talent that can talk to that script. They will therefore search for a performer who has the talent that can match that script. And that's where we see talent being displayed. Next slide. Now, let me again compare copyright with performance. In your workshop, I understand you were told what copyright means. It's a type of intellectual property that grants the author the exclusive right to do certain things, which we call them restricted acts, for a limited period of time. Sometimes those restricted acts are called monopoly, because these are the do's and the don'ts. But when we compare it with performance, performance simply means delivering, enacting, and giving rendition of a work. For a performance to be recognized in law as a right, it must be performing certain works. And in this case, it could be musical compositions or lyrics, or following a script in a film. But a performer must perform some works, which we find them in copyright. So to identify those works that can be performed by a performer, we therefore look at literary works, which very often will then produce a film script. A performer, in order for her or him to enjoy performance, protection for his or her performance, must be able to perform either literary work or musical works. When a performance is performed on a film script and fixated, it will then be found being condensed in a cinematograph film. It appears here in a fixated form. The same happens when a performer has performed musical compositions. If they are fixated or recorded, then we will find them in sound recording. So only literary works and musical works can be performed. And when they are fixated, we will see them in a sound recording, or we will see them in a cinematograph film. Next slide. So here is just a singer performing the musical works. And this is performance, because she is performing musical works. Next slide. Here is a performer or performers performing a script in a film. Whether fixated or unfixated, they are performing a work. And that work is literary work. Therefore, their performance is protected in law. Next slide. Now, because these are rights, they give a performer certain privileges. We call them monopoly or restricted acts. In other words, the Section 5 of the Performance Protection Act provides that no person shall, without the consent of the performer, broadcast or communicate to the public unfixed performance of such a performer. Section 5, subsection 1 of the Performance Protection Act is very important because it spells out these restricted acts, and it requires any person who wants to use that performance to get a consent from a performer. So a performer will enjoy the right to prevent others from making a fixation of the unfixed performance. Again, a performer enjoys a right to prevent other people from making a reproduction of his or her performance. So Section 5 is very, very, very important. In my view, is the nucleus of the Performance Protection Act, because these are the rights of performers, and they are exercised by these performers to ensure that they enjoy monopoly over their performances. Performances like copyright works, they can still be used without the consent of the performer, provided that they are used under the exceptions. And those exceptions are the same exceptions that we find in the Copyright Act. And when you were workshopped, I believe you were taken through exceptions. Exceptions are necessary so that the works can be used in the interest of the public. Next slide. In simple terms, just to give honorable members a simple understanding of these rights that we are dealing with. Performers are simply actors in films or audiovisual works. I will use film or audiovisual work interchangeably. In South Africa, our current act, they employ the term film, but we have seen other jurisdictions having migrated to a new term of audiovisual work for a film. So actors are performers are simply actors and singers, either in audiovisual work or in music sound recordings. I've indicated that singing and acting constitute performances and are protected in law. So in explaining performance, we can simply say these are related rights or neighboring rights. They are neighboring rights or related rights because they come from a secondary legislation. But we should not understand these rights to be inferior to the rights that are found in the Copyright Act over copyright works. They are rights in law. They enjoy same legal recognition in law. We have seen these rights being made inferior in the industry, but it shouldn't be. Maybe this is only because of economic systematic challenges and imbalances in the commercial market that subject this rise of the performers to be inferior when they are negotiating commercial deals. They shouldn't be inferior because they are right. They can dictate who they want to fixate their performances. They can decide who to consent to in terms of their performances being reproduced. So they can exercise these rights successfully. we have seen in other jurisdictions where performers have formed unions, and those unions, they advocate the rights of the performers. And they even have terms, standardized terms and conditions for engagement when performances are going to be used in the commercial market. But South Africa does not have that kind of a model. We have seen performers continue to contract individually over their performances, whether in film or during the recording of their performances in sound recordings. So South African actors are still contracting individually, and their contracts will always differ from one performer to another. Next slide. So in this slide, I'm just showing honorable members how these multiple rights can be compressed in one product. Even if they are compressed in one product, we should have the technical know-how of tracing them separately to ensure that they still enjoy their separate existence and recognition. For example, we know that in a film, the role players there will be the script writer. You will then have an actor who will then give a performance in that film. Then you will have the name of the movie, which could be a trademark. And then recently, we have seen sound recording being incorporated in films as a soundtrack. So these are the role players. Each and every one, they enjoy their separate rights. Now, because they commercialize their performances, they commercialize their works, we now see the law of contract playing a very important role to make sure that these rights attract that commercial gain. Obviously, a film producer will then approach a script writer, either license or buy that script. Sometimes, if the script writer is well educated with IP, that script writer will opt for joint ownership. But what we have seen, and in our engagement with script writers, performers, script writers often license or sell their script to film producers. Honorable members must also understand that when a performer consents for his or her performance to be dictated, there is a deeming provision which I will explain in the slides to come to say, once a performer consents to that, he is also consenting to the producer being the person who is going to commercialize the work that contains or features his or her performance. So honorable members must understand that deeming provision. Next slide. The same principle applies here. They are role players in a sound recording. Musical compositions have their own copyright. A trademark could be the name of the song or the track, and a performance will always be there so that a performer can display that talent. And that talent very often is the one that attracts that sound recording. I have observed in life, especially people who are fanatics of music, they will always associate each and every sound recording with a performer rather than a record producer is simply because they enjoy the talent that comes out of that scene. So performance play a very important role in making a sound recording to attract commercial gains in the market. Again, the same law of contract will then be used so that the sound recording producer can decide whether to get a license from music composer or buy the musical composition that is going to be part of the sound recording. But when we engage in the industry, music composers are often licensing. We are yet to see some deals that that are on joint ownership between music composer and owners of sound recordings. If they do exist, they should be in small number. But the law of contract will always be used to do those deals. Next slide. So we have seen in the industry the law of contract playing an important role to the extent where a performer and a producer of sound recordings will conclude recording deals. And in concluding those recording deals, we have seen contractual arrangements promoting or being based on advanced payments to the performers by record companies. A record company will be for the commercialization of the sound recording that features performance and agree with a performer to say, I'm giving you so much, and this is not just a free money. I'm going to recoup it when I start to commercialize the sound recording. And until I have recouped what I've given you, I will not be giving you any money other than the advance that I've given you. So we have seen those advanced payment models being on the rise in the music industry. But I must emphasize here again that performers, they do have rights, and they can exercise those rights in a manner that commercially benefits them. But as I've said, due to systematic challenges in the music industry, we have seen this advanced payment model being perpetuated. So this law of contracts allows this right to exchange hands in anticipation of commercial gain. And the law of contract or the freedom to contract forms a cornerstone of any intellectual property system, because these rights, if they are not exchanging hands, they will never attract any commercial gains or benefit for the right holders. So the law of contract continues to be a catalyst in any intellectual property system. Next slide. Now, I have taken the members through the Performance Protection Act insofar as the rights of the performers are concerned. Let me now link the performers' rights with international treaties, because these rights of the performers are also internationally recognized, and they are recognized in various treaties. I've just selected the treaties that give rise to the performers on an international plane. The first treaty that is also relevant in terms of granting the performers derive in the Rome Convention of 1961. Rome Convention deals with three categories of right holders. It grants rights to the performers. It also grants rights to producers of phonograms, which is your record companies. Then it goes further to give rights to broadcasting organizations such as our SABC and MultiChoice. Previous slide. So Rome Convention deals with those three categories of right holders. But it's important to note that the performers' rights were recognized as early as 1961. And our Performance Protection Act was a response to the Rome Convention. As a country, we responded to this international legal instrument and enacted our own national law, which also gave the performers the rights over their performances. If you can read our Performance Protection Act, it does mention the Rome Convention. Now, another treaty that is also relevant in terms of recognizing and giving the performers the rights over their performances is the WIPO Performances and Phonograms Treaty, which was concluded in 1996. This treaty is sometimes called Internet Treaty, together with the WIPO Copyright Treaty. They call them Internet Treaty simply because they were responding to technological evolution that invaded the creative industries across all the jurisdictions in the world. It was necessary for these rights to first be recognized at international level so that member states of WIPO can go to their national sphere and jurisdictions and craft a legislation that can also respond to this treaty. South Africa is not a member of Rome Convention. South Africa is not a member of WIPO Performances and Phonograms Treaty. But I must just mention that insofar as WIPO Performances and Phonograms Treaty, our Copyright Act together with Performance Protection Act were amended in 2006 to reflect or to include collective management of rights. And it took the provisions of this treaty. Section 5, subsection 1 of the Performance Protection Act was amended so that the performance becomes part of that collective management rights system, which comes from the WIPO Performance and Phonograms Treaty. Copyright Act was amended. We amended Section 9 as a country. We also inserted Section 9A, which prescribed how this collective management of rights in sound recording will be implemented. Another treaty that is also very important is the Beijing Treaty on the Protection of Audiovisual Performances, which was concluded in 2012. I was fortunate to be part of this diplomatic conference in Beijing. And it was clear during that diplomatic conference that many member states sympathized with the actors. And they were unanimous in terms of saying, let us recognize them internationally so that when we go home in our national sphere, we can then legislate national laws which will then respond to the Beijing Treaty on the Protection of Audiovisual Performance. As a country, we have not yet joined this treaty, but it's an important treaty for the actors because it even protects their performances when they are consumed on digital markets. So this treaty, in my view, is also an internet treaty because it responded to technological evolution for the digital markets. These treaties, in my view, recognized on international play the talent that we find in performances.
Cardi, sorry to interrupt. Your time is up, so if you can wrap up. I note that you are quite close to the end, but if you can maybe just speed up a little bit and then try and get to your slides. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Next slide. Next slide. So, honorable members, these are just the rights that comes from these three treaties. They are all aimed at benefiting the performers when their performances are consumed on digital market or even when they are communicated to the public. So you can go through those rights. They are very clear. They relate to reproduction, distribution, rental, making available, and broadcasting and communication to the public. Next slide. The duration of protection for performance in South Africa is 50 years from the day on which the performance took place, and it is fixated from the day on which it was recorded. Other jurisdictions have a longer duration of performance protection. Next slide. Exceptions on the use of performance. The same exceptions that are used in the Copyright Act are also applicable for performances. Performances can be used for purposes of criticism or review or reporting of current events, for teaching or scientific research, and also for legal proceedings in the interest of the public. Next slide. Offenses and liabilities in the same manner as they were presented by OND. They are the same when it comes to performances. We have criminal sanctions. We also have civil liabilities. But let me just also mention that in 2010, a collecting society by the name of SAMRO interdicted SAMPRA, which was a collecting society for owners of sound recording. The reason why they interdicted them is they formulated a distribution plan without their involvement. My point here is to emphasize that the rights of performers are rights in law and they can be enforced. They should not be understood to be inferior to other rights that are found in copyright. What SAMPRA did, they successfully interdicted SAMPRA from distributing those royalties on the basis that they were not consulted or they were not involved in that formulation of the distribution plan, whereas they have a material interest in that distribution. Their material interest is simply because those sound recordings featured their performances and they have rights to those performances. And that's my emphasis. Next slide. So, honorable members, chairperson, I think this little presentation should be able to assist you as you'll be deliberating on these two bills that are before you. I thank you.
you very much, Kadi. I'm glad that we could sort your technology challenges out in the end, because it was a quite an interesting presentation. Chair, if I may then hand back to you for the discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Advocate, and also thanks to Mr. Bridger for the presentation. I thought that it was important that we start with the presentation before the question, because the question may be similar for both presentations. So there was already a question. I hope that Mr. Bezo also had the question from Honorable Moimang that arose from the input of Professor Dean with regard to why only one case so far he's aware of. Maybe you can also come in terms of responding to that question. I don't know if honorable members, there are any other questions, even from members from the portfolio committees from the provinces. I see the hand of honorable Moimang Pati. I will encourage members from the provincial legislators, they are free also to ask questions if they have any. Honorable Moimang, we can come in again.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate the second presenter for the presentation made. Chair, the distinction made by the teacher on the primacy of the copyright vis-a-vis the secondary nature of the Performance Act. Is the distinction itself not problematic in the sense that one should start from the basis that all legislation are primary, and we have drawn a distinction between a regulation and policy and a legislation. And by so doing, is that in itself not elevating the copyright above the performance, the copyright act above the performance act. The second point, the competing rights. The competing rights between various role players, whether it's the scriptwriter, whether it's the producer, whether it's the performer, is there no way in which the role players could be much more elaborated, such that we are then able to mitigate the impact of the law of contract into a larger extent disadvantaging other role players. The reason why I'm raising this point is the visual effect that he did make a reference to the systemic nature of challenges that sometimes are found in this industry, which to a larger extent a performer then as a result of the example that he alluded to around the advance payment by the recording labels and the performer coming into an agreement that until
recouping this particular amount, there shall be no payment, which to another extent has led to the situation that I believe these two acts are geared towards addressing. But it's just emphasis on the point that he raised. There are systemic problems that to another extent you then found such a situation where the law of contract trumps over the rights of the performers as protected by the legislation. Is there no way in which this matter can be dealt with? Raising this point is precisely by virtue of the fact that the only contracts that are vulnerable to attack, the only contracts that can be set aside, the only contracts that are vulnerable in nature. What is it that we need to do to make sure that legislation remains primacy? And even though the law of contract is at the center of what has been happening, we are then able to use the legislation to sort of close those gaps that the law of contract seems to be exploiting. Thank you, Chair.
No, thank you very much, Honourable Moima. Are there any other questions, Honourable Members? Seems none. Can I just check maybe from the committee secretary first? I noticed that after Professor Dean finished his input, then we got this thing that says proceedings are recorded. Was it a mistake not to record them earlier, or there was no consent given by Professor Dean?
It was a mistake on our side, but we will endeavor to ensure that we do get the recordings as well.
Oh, okay. No, because he was saying when he was delivering the input that he was performing, and that his performance was then protected. So I thought that maybe he has not given the consent. But also maybe linked to that, now, because this workshop is being broadcast as we speak on YouTube and Twitter, what does it mean then in terms of the consent and with regard to infringement? If you could clarify that as well. But also on the disposition of the performer's right, how would you know if a person is not being, pushed to assign instead of giving license? What protection around that can be guaranteed that a person is not being perhaps intimidated to assign instead of just giving the license? The example that we're making about the ownership of a house and leasing of the house, how would you know if this person is forced to sell the house instead of leasing it? If we can get responses, perhaps both of you, we can come in terms of responses, maybe from different angles. We'll start with you, Professor D. Can you please unmute yourself? You're muted. Yes, you can go ahead.
Yeah, I just... to begin with, I'd like to just pick up on a couple of points you yourself made, Mr. Chairman. Firstly, the question of proceedings are recorded. I have no problem with that. And I guess that what happened was that someone suddenly tumbled to the idea that you actually, as an organization that is busy making a recording, needed such a permission in terms of the Performers Protection Act. So whoever put up that notice was just being mindful of what was required under the Performance Protection Act. But another factor which should come into play is the whole question of implied licenses. I mean, take my position. I am aware that I was told in advance that this session would be recorded and broadcast as well. Now, if I go into, I was never asked whether I consented, but if I go into an arrangement like that, knowing that it is going to be broadcast and recorded, then I'm giving an implied license, an implied consent to that happening anyway. So implied licenses can play a very big role in intellectual property. The second point is you've mentioned performers being pushed to, that's the term you used, to assign their rights. Well, in fact, they cannot assign their rights. As I mentioned when I was doing my presentation, for some reason in the Performance Protection Act, there is no facility for a performer to assign his rights. And perhaps that was done deliberately to avoid performers being placed in a situation where they could be pushed into transferring their rights. So that particular problem ought not to arise. Not with performers anyway, it can happen with in copyright. Right, to begin, now let's start at the beginning. The Honorable Moema raised a number of different issues. The question of why so few cases, I actually don't know. I mean, the Performance Protection Act is used almost on a daily basis when permissions are given and contracts are entered into to give permissions. So it's not as if the Act is not being used, but what is clearly not happening is that performers are not taking action to enforce their rights in the court. Now, let me just draw a comparison with the copyright situation. When I did my doctorate and I produced my textbook, which was in the late 1980s, I made conducted considerable research, my objective was to locate every single South African copyright case which had taken place prior to that date, let's say 1986. Now, copyright has been operating in South Africa since the 1800s for the best part of 200 years. I could only find 17 cases. So in the 200 years, starting in 1800s through to the late 1980s, there were only 17 copyright cases in South Africa. I then produced my textbook, which was essentially the first textbook on copyright law, and it, I think, opened people's eyes as to what possibilities copyright presented in order to use economic situations and benefit themselves. And what happened was that immediately there was a flare-up in copyright cases. And as was said in my introduction, or the introduction given in respect of me, I personally have acted in over 50 copyright infringement cases in the last 30 years. There have probably been maybe 75 South African cases in the last 30 years. So for 200 years, there were 17 cases. The next 30-odd years, there were 75 cases. And I attribute that to the fact that people became aware of copyright. As lawyers started finding out about copyright, they started realizing what it could do for their clients if they exercised their rights under copyright. Now, there has been very little writing about performance protection. I included a chapter on performance protection in my textbook, and in fact is the printed document which I provided for circulation. That is really the only writing that has been done in terms of performance protection. It's an area of the law that nobody knows anything about. And I attribute, if you're asking me for a reason why there's only been one case, it's because people don't know about the law and they don't know what rights it offers them, what opportunities it offers them. So that's my sort of off-the-cuff view as to why there's been so few little activity. the question of performance protection being secondary rights or in some way inferior rights, they are not. They are self-standing. They have exactly the same status as copyright or any other intellectual property rights. I think why it might have come about to some extent is that the Berne Convention dates from the 1800s. At that stage, no one had ever thought of performance protection. Sound recordings were just about non-existent. Even broadcasting was just about non-existent. So the Berne Convention only dealt with literary music, artistic works, and cinematograph films. As the years progressed, it became the realization dawned that intellectual property needed to cover other kinds of works as well. And so a sort of a supplement was brought out, considered for the Berne Convention, and they, which then extended to cover sound recordings and the other types of rights, including performance protection rights. And they were referred to as neighboring rights. Neighboring in the sense that they weren't included in the Berne Convention, not neighboring because they were in any way inferior, but they weren't included in the Berne Convention, and they've never been included in the Berne Convention. So that's why they are considered to be somewhat separate and apart from the, let's call it, the primary rights. There's no suggestion that they are in any way inferior. How to manage competing rights? I think it's wrong to consider that the law of contract is some sort of bad guy that is having a malevolent influence on the exercise of intellectual property rights. That is not so at all. Where the law of contract comes into play is the question of giving permission. The Copyright Act and the Performance Protection Act give restricted acts. And if third parties want to exercise these restricted acts, they have to get permission. And that is done in a contract. So that's the significance of contracts. The contracts govern the manner in which the monopolistic rights are exercised by third parties. Now, South Africa prides itself, and our courts repeatedly say this, and it's been mentioned in today, that there is a basic principle of freedom of contract. People should be free to set to agree their relationships how they want to agree their relationships. Bargaining positions come into play. If you are a well-known author and you want to publish a book, you can dictate your terms to your publisher. There may be publishers who are queuing up to want to publish your book, so you are in a strong bargaining position. If you're a first-time author, you never published a book in your life before, you're trying to beg a publisher to publish your book, the publisher's in the strong bargaining position. You're going to get a worse deal in your contract than will happen in the case where you are a well-known author. And that's a fact of economic life. I mean, the intellectual property complies with the normal economic principles of supply and demand and market preferences and all that sort of thing. Unfortunately, performers, probably because they've been to some extent ignorant of their rights, have not been assertive in coming forward with stating their terms. I mean, there are enough performers in South Africa who are well-known, very famous, and who are in a position to dictate to record companies and broadcasters and so forth what the terms of the arrangement should be. Talking about how the remuneration is provided and the question of a lump sum payment, that is one of the ways in which remuneration can be given to a rights owner for the use of his rights, whether he's a performer or a copyright owner. Same principle applies. It's not an evil thing, an upfront payment. Let me tell you, I published a book about 10 years ago where the publisher approached me and said, we would like you to write this book. And we're prepared to give you a 10,000 Rand upfront payment. And thereafter, no royalties. I chose to go with that arrangement because I thought it would be beneficial to me, because the value of it is that the book might never sell a single copy, but you still get your 10,000 Rand. The alternative is to say, well, I want 2 Rand for every copy that is sold, and if only 100 copies are sold, you end up earning next to nothing. So you've got to, this comes back to the question of freedom of contract. You've got to suss out the commercial opportunities of your work when you agree to the form of remuneration. I mean, there are various possibilities. You can take the upfront payment and get no royalties. You can get only royalties based on sales down the line with no upfront payment, or you can get a combination of the two. And you, as the rights holder, have got to weigh up which is going to be better for you. And so there's nothing evil about offering an upfront payment. As I said, it gives you certainty. It's the situation of the bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. If you get an upfront payment, at least you know you're going to get something. So I wouldn't poo-poo the upfront payment as being a worthwhile way of getting remuneration. How to manage competing rights is a very difficult situation. As I mentioned, if I do, I'm a singer, I do a music video, I'm giving a performance of a musical work, the melody, under copyright. I'm giving a performance of the lyrics, a literary work, under copyright. I go to the record company, I grant the record company the right to record my performance and also the right to make a reproduction of the literary work and the artistic work. The record company goes to the broadcaster and says to the broadcaster, you want to use my record to do a broadcast, that's fine, but you've got all of these different rights holders involved and they're all entitled to some form of remuneration. Now, how you manage all of that, how the broadcaster pays the record company, how the record company pays the performer, and how the performer pays the literary copyright owner and the musical copyright owner, is a very complex setup. And one has to approach it in a very scientific and analytic way. And so it helps to have collecting societies, for instance, where a body can negotiate on behalf of a variety of different rights holders. But however you look at it, it remains a very complicated process. And it's all regulated by the law of contract, because each of those permissions that have to be obtained have to be contained in a contract. So one has to, you can't take a superficial view of all of this. You have to really sit down and analyze what exactly is happening, who's doing what and who's entitled to what, and then try and put it all together in an omelette. And it's, believe me, a very difficult process. And lawyers who do this sort of thing have to be very skilled in what they're doing. That's all I have to, well, just a couple of points arising from Cardi's presentation, if I may. He placed the emphasis on performances in films and records, which is not wrong, because that's probably the main area in which performers' rights come into contention. But you must realize that it's not only those kind of performers that are involved. It's performances of all kinds of works. I read out to you, and I'll just repeat it, what the law has to say. The performances protected by the Act are those of actors, singers, musicians, dancers, and other persons who act, sing, deliver, declaim, play, or otherwise perform literary, music, dramatic music, artistic works, expressions of folklore. So when a poet stands up and reads a poem, he's giving a performance. I mentioned that what I'm doing here and now is giving a performance. So the law has to cater for all of these kinds of performances, not only for singers and actors. As I said, they are probably the most prominent kind of performers, but they're not the only performers. And the law can't focus only on those people. It has to focus on performers across the board. I think that's enough for the moment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's give over to Mr. Petcher.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'll try to give a sort of an umbrella view on the things that have been raised. I think the first point is to say intellectual property with copyright system being part of it. It's a foreign system to the African continent. And it's not amazing that it started as early as 1886 through the Bern Convention. So when it is introduced to some of the regions across the globe, there are a lot of things that are dependent on that system to work properly. When I look at the entire copyright ecosystem, I don't think there is one institution or department that can really solve these issues. But we need a contribution from all the role players in the ecosystem, have an integrated approach. One of the reasons for that is maybe the market forces might dictate something that is quite opposite to what we want in our law, in the sense that these rights are private rights in nature, and I do not envisage or foresee any situation whereby each and every right holder, when he's making a deal, somebody can just be there to assist. It's not possible. These rights must be managed privately by the right holders. And the only thing that is required, in my view, is this continuous education and awareness on these rights so that they can understand how best to approach some of the deals. But at the same time, it's very difficult to also pronounce to say which deal is good, which deal is not good. So there are a lot of things that we need to take into consideration, which are not necessarily copyright issues. They are issues outside the copyright system as well. So that's one thing. I also agree with Dr. Dean that performances should not only be limited to those that are fixated in sound recording and films. They are also theatrical performances, which are also able to generate revenue or royalties for the performers. I just took those because I thought they are often used, and every day we relate to them when we watch TVs, when we listen to music. But indeed, I agree that there are also other performances that are not necessarily in film and sound recording. As a copyright office, time and again, we advise right holders to go for a licensee rather than selling of the intellectual property right itself, especially for those who have produced copyright works, because you can sell them right away. The reason for that is we believe that when it's licensed, after the expiry of a licensing period, very often you will find that the work is now even more expensive than it has been. Or it also gives the right holder an opportunity to resume the contract, unlike where it has been sold, and at the later stage, it turns out that it's now becoming even more commercially valuable. That means its price might have increased. So we always advise for a licensing rather than outright selling. So, but still, it will be naive for us as a copyright office to say licensing is always better than outright selling, because each and every case must depend on its own circumstances. There are those musicians these days who will produce these sound beats in numbers, and they sell them right away. They will tell you that this is what I want, I will produce other ones, and then they are able to make quick monies. And the question of contracts is very difficult again, because when we engage the industry very often cautioned us to say, you must not discourage the freedom to contract, because these products, these works, must be able to exchange hands, must be able to be licensed to the user so that they can attract those commercial gains. So if we're going to discourage the freedom to contract in this space, it might stifle the system as a whole. So before we can say the contracts are not necessarily benefiting certain category of right holders, I think the best way is to keep on educating the right holders about intellectual property, educating them about the options that they might have in terms of dealing with this product that belongs to them. So yeah, some of the things are not necessarily challenges that reside in the copyright system, but it could be market, the behavior of the market forces, the economic state of our country, taking into account the historical issues. So the combination of that really makes our copyright system a little bit tricky. And it's always difficult to advise in certain circumstances. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much, Mr. Pizzi.
Could I just come in and just comment on one of the statements that Cardi's made, which I support, and I want to support him in it, and that is that freedom of contract is very important, because it allows nuanced approaches, which, as he says, can take account of changing circumstances, different circumstances, and particular circumstances. And I'm against any system which seeks to restrain or restrict freedom of contract, to impose a particular solution on rights holders, which says you have to assign the copyright or the whatever the right it is, you have to go for a license, which is a royalty payment over a period. That is actually taking away the rights of the rights owners, because it is saying to them, instead of having the full spectrum of possible ways of earning money, we are requiring you to stick to one particular way of earning money. And it may not be the best type of way of earning money in all circumstances. You face with a situation here where one size does not fit all. And freedom of contract enables you to deal with that situation. And I also want to support him on his view that education is so important. I come back to the point that I think that there's been very little enforcement activity in the field of performance contract, because people are ignorant. They do not know what their rights are. And the only way in which people can get to know what their rights are is by way of education. And consequently, education is of the utmost importance. Thank you.
We should conduct that education.
Sorry?
Is it the responsibility of the department?
Well, I think the department...
We should conduct the education so that everyone...
Chair, if I may, obviously the Copyright Office could be the leading organization, but we need to work with all role players in the ecosystem. For instance, you have other organizations such as National Video and Film Foundation that is responsible for funding of these film scripts from the inception. So you need to get all the role players so that each and every player can contribute to the system of copyright in terms of education, their mandate. There is no super department or super organization that alone can fix any intellectual property system or copyright system. That is why in other countries, and South Africa does not have this, they have crafted what we call intellectual property strategy or copyright strategy, so that they will prescribe in that document where they want to focus on and who are the role players who should then deal with those issues. So it's very important that as a country we need to even go to a level where we gauge where we are strong, we gauge where we are weak, and start to focus on areas where we are very strong and assist these right holders to even commercialize their product outside our country so that they can repatriate those revenues that they get from other jurisdictions back to the country and do more job creation and grow our businesses. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much. Honorable members, are there any follow-up questions?
Could I make a follow-up comment, please? When I started the Chair of Intellectual Property Law at Stellenbosch University, one of the objectives I set for the chair and for myself was to do what I called popularizing intellectual property. And by that I meant bringing it to the masses, to let the world out there know more about intellectual property and what it can offer. And so we started, a layman's course on intellectual property at the university. Once a year, a workshop is held for a few days to which non-lawyers are invited or given the opportunity of coming so that they can learn something about intellectual property. We also started a blog which enabled people to write articles about intellectual property, but not articles aimed at lawyers or judges or academics, articles aimed at the man in the street. And although it's a small step, it is a step in the direction of what I'm propagating, namely getting the world out there to know more about intellectual property.
Thank you so much, Prof. I see that there are no follow-up hands from members. I don't know if there are any comments from Advocate Fanemefe before we get to the next item.
Thank you, Chair. I have no input. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. Honourable members, my observation, perhaps let's take this opportunity then to first thank Professor Dean and Mr. Pichel for the sharing information on the performance protection. We did receive the presentation, but it is very good when you're taken through those presentations. So sometimes when you are all by yourself reading some, you don't understand some of the concepts. but when you are taken through to the delivery then of the inputs, the presentation, you get to further understand the meaning of those concepts. So thank you very much, because this will, as CIPC was indicating, that it's going to assist when we deal now with the actual amendments, bills to the Principal Act. Thank you very much, Prof. You were last week and you are here again this week to assist us. We really appreciate it. But also, we would encourage provinces, if they would like also to have workshops, they could do so, but also they could perhaps get copies of the Zoom copies of these proceedings, last week's proceedings and this week's proceedings. But also this information are also, I think, stored in YouTube and Twitter, but also in the website of Parliament. Those who are not here can be able to access those proceedings recorded with the understanding that consent has been granted to so. So that when you deal with your own processes in the provinces, you also have an understanding of where these concepts, when they were translated or interpreted to us as members, but also I had also observed last week that some provincial members had to join their plenary sessions. So they must have missed out in the afternoon when we're continuing with the workshop. So that's why I will also urge them maybe to contact the committee secretaries for the copies of the Zoom, or go to the YouTube or to the Twitter and get the proceedings of last week, because it's going to assist them also when they deal with these processes in terms of understanding the concepts and also the context. What we want to suggest as well, in case provincial delegates or members from the legislatures again leave us and join their plenary sessions, we would like to take members and the vote from the committee and the legislature through the legislative process that we'll be embarking upon with regard to dealing with the two bills. But before that, I see the hand of the committee secretary.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I just wanted to indicate that following last week's meeting, we did circulate the presentations to the legislatures. We've also sent them the link to the recording as well. So just to indicate that we have done so.
All right. No, thank you so much. I think that really helps. Because even some of us, myself included, I also want to utilize also maybe this December period, also to even go back to the link and go through the documents that were circulated, but also the videos of the presentation of the panelists that we had last week, and also those that are here, so that as we interact with the legislation, you know, become aware of all these concepts and their context, because when we engage then with the public submissions, that also is another process of education. We'll always revert back to the inputs that we've received last week and also this week. I would encourage other members also to do the same, both in the province and also in the committee here. Again, I would like to thank Prof. I don't know if you have any parting shots from your side, and also Mr. Petcher.
Yes, I would like to just
Am I mute or not?
Yeah, no, we can hear you.
Okay. I would just like to, in a way, sympathize with your committee and with the provinces, because as you will have gathered from these workshops, intellectual property law is a very complicated and unknown area of the law. It's very difficult for even lawyers to understand, let alone non-lawyers. The one judge once described it as a very technical subject, by which he meant that you really, for someone coming in from the outside without knowing all the nuts and bolts, it becomes a very difficult subject matter to handle. Now, your legislators are faced with a problem where they are starting with a very complicated area of the law, and then they are being asked to look at amendments which are equally complex and difficult, and come up with the right results in the end. And that is a very difficult task. And that is a task which I think is assisted by workshops such as these, and getting input from people who know the subject matter, because only in that way can you begin to do the job properly. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Mr. Petzer, your departing shot. I don't know if he's still around. Departing shot, Mr. Petzer, I don't think he's around there, because maybe he was experiencing challenges with his device. Maybe he has a lockout. Okay, Honourable Member, let me ask then the Enrico or Committee Secretary to flight what I suggest, because I'm fearing a situation where members from the legislatures won't be here this afternoon, so that we take them through the process that we will be embarking upon. We last weekend, this week, we've been dealing then with the workshop on the copyright amendment bill, but not specifically the bill, but the copyright law and also the performance protection law, so that we understand the concepts and also the context. What we plan then to do is that between the first and the fifth, in terms of the cycle of dealing with Section 76 bills, we plan to brief provinces as permanent delegates. We liaison with the PLOs, and the PLOs and the legislatures should liaise with the department, so that there should be also briefing in the provinces. So after, we'll be issuing out adverts to newspapers and radios for public comments. We expect that we will then receive and stakeholders. The advert will then, from our side as a committee, nationally, will close on the 27th of January 2023. We will then, on the 21st of February, have a public hearings, the 21st and also the 28th. We'll continue with the public hearings. And again on the 7th of March, public hearing. What we also requesting, the reason why also we're putting this so that also the provinces take it to account, is that we also understand that provinces will also have their own programs. After they receive the briefings, they will also advertise for the public involvement. After receiving the inputs or submission from the public, they will also sit as a portfolio committees to consider the submissions and then develop their negotiating mandates. We are suggesting that those meetings or the negotiating mandates must be sent to us by the 9th. So on the 9th, the committee should be considering those negotiating mandates from the provinces, and also on the 16th of May. The reason we're asking that, because we will be having a public hearings as a committee, and then we will consolidate the position of the committee as a committee, to consolidate that and then send those to the provinces, so that as the provinces consider the negotiating mandate, also they take into account what comes from the committee, our select committee, into account as they develop their negotiating mandates. And then once that is then done, we will then consider the negotiating mandates and then make our views as a committee on the negotiating mandate, send back our views, which will also take into account the responses of the department on the negotiating mandates that will be coming from the provinces. We'll make that available, including the minutes of the committees. Once that is then done, we will await then for the final mandates from the provinces that will go to the chairperson of the National Council of Provinces, and then those then will be giving us as a committee the position. Even if the 5 provinces were in favor, then means we'll go to the plenary session of the NCOP and the table report and also indicate that so many provinces have voted in the RF4. But also if there are fewer than 5, it would mean that the bills have no support. So that would be a process. But the one that we wanted to emphasize on is this one of we know that this is a six-week cycle. We will also be writing to the chairperson to plan extension, because one other issue that we are concerned about is that that's why we even will be having our adverts in January, because some people may not take note if we have this advert in December, because December is a very busy month. So some people may complain that we advertise on a wrong month and they did not focus. So that's why we're having it in January. So the emphasis on our part is that before you continue with the negotiating money, please wait for the report that we'll be submitting to provinces that take into account, because some of the stakeholders may not necessarily make their submission in the provinces. They will make their submission to the committee nationally, and we need to consider their submission and also the responses of the department, and then develop a report that will then share with the provinces. Wanted to indicate that before perhaps some of you then join the plenary sessions of your legislatures. I don't know if there are any questions. It seems they're not. At this stage, then unless the Commerce Secretary will advise, at this stage we'll adjourn for lunch, and then we will resume. I think at 1:30. I don't have my program now because I'm using the same screen for Zoom. We will then resume at 1:30, and then the department will take us through the two bills, and then we allow members to ask questions for clarities. And then once that is all done, we will then invite Advocate Fanemeve and just a brief overview on the Constitutional Court decision on the issue of the challenge by the Blind South Africa organization that outcome. As I indicated earlier, that the detailed analysis of such will then be dealt with in other meetings of the committee. Any comments, Secretary, Advocate, before we adjourn?
No comments, but just to say there was one item that we might have left off the legislative program, which was actually departmental responses to the issues raised in the public hearings, but we'll make sure to include that in our program as well.
Okay. No, that's fine. Yeah. Because usually when we have these submission from the public, we send them also to the department so that they prepare their responses as well. And then we'll invite them to come and brief the committee on their responses to the committee, to those submissions. And then we deliberate as a committee and develop a position as I was indicating, and those positions will form part of the report that will then send to the provinces so that when they deal with the negotiating mandates, they consider the submissions from the public as well as the responses of the department. Yeah, thank you very much. Honorable members, I will request that we come back exactly 20 past 1, so that we start exactly on time at 1:30. The meeting is adjourned for now. Thank you very much.
Recording stopped.